is Ann Samalik and John Samalik versus Dorothea Berth. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Morning, Mr. Chief Justice. William Wright for the petitioner appellants, the Samaliks.
And John Burke for defendants Zalona and Robert DeStefanis.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Wright, you may proceed and you may take your mask off as you make your presentation. That applies to all counsel when you're presenting your arguments.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices. May it please the court. I'm so happy to be back in a real courtroom, and I'm so happy to have been here for this, first of all. So thank you for that.
Thank you, and I'll ask you to try to keep your voice up as you're presenting.
Sure, I apologize. So it's not often at argument that one gets to quote Benjamin Cardozo in a meaningful way that applies directly to the issues in a case. But I'm taking this opportunity to do just that. And then Judge Cardozo in 1921 said it better, more articulately than I ever could about the rescue doctrine. And that is, danger invites rescue. The cry of distress is the summons to relief. The law does not ignore these reactions of the mind in tracing conduct to its consequences. It recognizes them as normal, and it places their effects within the range of the natural and the probable. That's the broad definition, the description of the rescue doctrine. And today we're here to ask this court to recognize the reactions of the mind of the plaintiff in this case and other plaintiffs who may chase dogs into lagoons, cars rolling down hills, or things that may be on fire. You know, this case involved a very simple issue with very limited guidance, especially in this state. The only thing we know in New Jersey is that the rescue doctrine is ingrained in the fabric of our law and always has been. But the question about whether it applies to property, which we know a pet is, has not been answered here. So we had to go digging through ancient case law from 50 states. And we found that about half of the states in the country have dealt with this issue in some way, whether the subject matter of that case was specific to property or whether more broadly they cited the doctrine and described it as including property, okay? Of the 26 or so cases that have addressed the issue in some way, only two, Kansas and Missouri, have said it doesn't apply to property. The rescue doctrine doesn't apply to property. New Hampshire limited the doctrine somewhat, applies only to property in which a person may have a legal interest. Every other court to think about this issue, I think there were 11 or 12 that addressed it squarely and said, yes, the rescue doctrine applies to property. Another 10, 9 or 10, were applying the doctrine in the context of life or limb, but quoted the restatement. The restatement, which considers a reasonable effort to save a third person or the land or chattels of himself or a third person. And that is the restatement. That's this aggregation of the American Law Institute's, you know, survey of all 50 states and what the law is around the country. There's only two states that limit the doctrine to the rescue of people. And I think that really is because of what Judge Cardozo said in 1921. The law does not ignore these reactions of the mind. And this court shouldn't ignore the reactions of the mind in this case, where the plaintiff was summoned for relief and did so and was gravely injured as a result. This court should remain in step with the majority of our sister states. Like the appellate division said, the way it stands now, we seem out of step because we don't apply the rescue doctrine as broadly as it's applied in almost every jurisdiction to consider this issue. I thank the court, and I'm loath to yield my time for rebuttal, but the issues in this case are straightforward, and the determination here is, are we going to be in step with the majority, and are we going to recognize the reactions of the mind of people who are called to rescue not just other people, but property which includes family pets.
Counsel, should there be any limits to that doctrine? Assuming this court were to agree with you and determine that it applies to property, not just individuals or persons, are there any limits to that? In other words, should the object be considered, whether it's trivial or not, in this case we have a dog, but let's say it was someone's watch that they dropped in the street negligently and you ran out and got run over by a tractor trailer to protect the watch. Should there be some limits to what you suggest?
There should, and there are.
And what would those limits be?
Those limits are reasonableness, and that issue generally is for the jury. Now, the most egregious cases, the most trivial items, well, like the watch, would be considered on summary judgment.
That's my next question. The reasonableness, is that based on the object or on the actions of the rescuing individual, or both?
I think it's both. And I think the question would be, could a rational juror conclude, under the summary judgment standard, could a rational juror conclude that it was wise to run out into moving traffic to save somebody's watch?
Well, the reason I use Rolex is it's fairly expensive, and as opposed to your local Timex. So does that factor in, the value of the property being saved? Should that be part of the equation?
I think it could, and I think that's part of the reasonableness analysis, and that could be a question for the jury.
It's a two-prong analysis, according to you. The reasonableness of the person rescuing or saving the property, their actions, and not only that, but the actual thing being saved, the res being saved, for lack of a better term.
Correct. I think both should be considered in determining the reasonableness of the conduct.
But you wouldn't consider it reasonable for someone to go in front of a tractor trailer to rescue a Rolex instead of a Timex, would you?
I would.
I'm not a rational juror, but if I were, I probably wouldn't consider that reasonable. Yeah,
you referred to reasonableness as involving whether it was wise. I don't think that's really a part of any kind of reasonableness standard, is it?
It's not. And the reasonableness standard would be, is the rescuer acting reasonably under the circumstances? It's the reasonable man standard, not the wise man standard.
And I know your position is that takes care of everything. That takes care of the trivial cases. That takes care of the cases where really there should be no cause of action. But there is also a case being made that categories, obviously your adversary is saying all property, dog, fire, everything, but there's also a case to be made that categories of property are different from other categories. You obviously the dog has value to an individual. If there's a fire, someone comes upon a neighbor's house on fire, there may be someone, it may turn out that there was no one there, it may not be just property, but there's a danger to people involved in a house that's on fire. What about those cases where all that's involved is we're talking about watches here, an inanimate object, in which the category of what is being rescued, if you call rescuing and a thing rescuing, is such that it could never be reasonable for someone to put themselves in danger to save that property. Well, why shouldn't those categories be just off limits to this doctrine?
I think those categories are impossible to define as a matter of law. And I think that question, where that line should be drawn, when you inch ever closer to that trivial object, that Timex versus that Rolex, that's where you get a feel for the case as a trial judge, where you could grant or deny summary judgment, and if that summary judgment motion is denied, that issue goes to a jury. I don't think there can be a bright line of category.
How would people know whether the rescue is going to be treated a certain way? Well, of course, they don't know they're going to be injured when they engage in the rescue, but there should be some notice to counsel, some ability to explain to their clients, because I'm not talking about once you get here, or trial court judge's call. But when someone's in your office and they're asking you, do we have a case or not? What do we have? How would you be able to explain to your client and protect your malpractice if you don't know what's covered and what isn't, what would be protected, what wouldn't. We need to give notice of some supper notice to counsel and to the parties beforehand.
I agree, and as a plaintiff lawyer, you know, that's my plate every day. Every difficult case that comes through my office, I have to make that decision, and I have to say, well,
that's why you should do defense work, because your client didn't do it. He wasn't here. She wasn't there. And if they did, they weren't injured.
That's right. It was just a Rolex, after all. But that's exactly it. You know, we have to vet these cases. I have an obligation to not bring frivolous cases. I have an obligation to look at liability issues and say, geez, I just don't think we could prove this case. I don't think this will carry the day, and I'm going to decline this new client who came to my office who chased the Rolex out into traffic.
I'm sorry, Chief, please go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You began your presentation by speaking about the doctrine, how danger invites the response, and the case law in much of the jurisdictions that you referenced involved an element of danger that prompted a rescue effort, like the house on fire, the runaway truck, criminal activity going on a neighbor's property. Have jurisdictions that have embraced the doctrine applied it to the rescue of pets?
No, they haven't. This would be the first court to specifically address pets under the rescue doctrine.
So how do you compare that situation to situations that involve danger when analyzing the reasonableness component?
Well, I think that goes to how society views the family pet in 2022. And if you look across the ages, you know, pets have been around since time immemorial, but our relationship with animals has changed from the days where we would keep dogs in a kennel in our backyard for hunting in the 20s and 30s to the days now where the dog sleeps on your bed and you dress it up for holidays. The danger to a pet currently is same as, if not equal to, in our society, the danger to a human who is crying out for the rescue of a child or a family member. I would argue that the pet, this day and age, is of greater value, summons more relief than the shed that's on fire.
Does that apply to all pets? If you have a beloved rabbit or hamster, would the doctrine apply there as well?
I think it would, and I think it would go then to the reasonableness standard. Is a $12 parakeet that you just bought at PetSmart 2 days ago the same as the lizard that maybe lived with you for 20 years through your college career? I don't know the answer to that. And I don't think as a matter of law, we can know the answer to that.
Are you asking us to adopt the analysis that is performed under the second restatement of torts, section 472? Where you're looking at the danger to the person. I mean, there will be instances where the danger is so great and so unlikely to succeed that it would be unreasonable to make the effort, like a burning house that is ablaze. It might be worth the effort to save a child or a baby, but not a dog. Would you agree?
I would agree. And, you know, there are some of the cases that actually talk about that, and it goes to the danger. One of the cases from out of jurisdiction, I can't remember which state, was a case that involved someone who went into a burning building to get some personal belongings. That person was denied relief because their actions were unreasonable, partly because the fire was already under control, and they had no way and weren't contributing anything to the actual rescue. They just ran in, grabbed some stuff, and there, I think, as a matter of law, the court said, no relief, because they couldn't conclude that a rational juror would say, well, running into a burning building for some personal belongings is reasonable under the circumstances.
Even in your case, you wanted to go to the jury, but the jury would have to determine whether or not the effort to save the dog was so dangerous that it was unreasonable to jump into the bay.
Correct.
One question. I mean, we're talking a lot about reasonableness, and but isn't really a threshold question. In order to impose liability on the part of a defendant, a homeowner, a pet owner, isn't it really whether, in order to impose liability, whether it's foreseeable to that owner that their negligent act will invite risk, will invite danger to whoever's trying to, in other words, if you let your dog jump in the canal, is it foreseeable to you that somebody might jump in the canal to save that dog? And isn't that also a threshold question, whether or not the person acts reasonably in saving the object or the pet, whether it was foreseeable? In other words, and I'm coming back to the rabbit or the hamster, use that as an example. Is it foreseeable that somebody's going to risk their life to save a rabbit or a hamster? I don't know. That may be a question for the jury, too. It may be foreseeable, more foreseeable, that they'll save somebody's house where people may or may not be inside, or a dog. Isn't foreseeability another threshold question? And how do you assess that?
It is another threshold question, but I think, and this gives me another opportunity to quote Cardozo, the wrongdoer may not have foreseen the coming of a deliverer, but he is accountable as if he had. In other words, the doctrine essentially creates foreseeability under the law. If you create a situation that begets rescue, you, as a matter of law, that rescue is foreseeable, whether it is a dog, a burning building, a property.
If it begets rescue, and I guess that's where I'm coming from. If you have an object, you have a watch, and you drop your watch, is it foreseeable that somebody's going to jump in the street or dive down a sewer or jump in a canal to try to pull it out? I don't think so, and maybe summary judgment's granted at that point, not because the person who did it, well, probably that too. Anyway, isn't foreseeability applicable, a threshold question, and that is as important as the reasonable conduct of the rescuer?
I agree. That could be part of the analysis. That should be part of the analysis.
Mr. Wright.
No, please go ahead.
So, Mr. Wright, going back to some of the other jurisdictions, so you've conceded that none of those cases are on point with this case because they don't involve the rescue of dogs. We've also noted that many of those cases adopt the restatement. But in looking at some of those cases, even in the cases that do cite to the restatement, the holding appears to be specifically with regard to rescuing a person. So, for example, the Iowa case, the Hollingsworth case. Mm-hmm. Although the court cites to the restatement, immediately thereafter, the court presents a hypothetical that solely involves the rescue of a person. So, and I think there's at least one other case, the Connecticut case, where the court held specifically that the property at risk was in a situation involving a fire. So did not appear to extend the rescue doctrine to any other instances of property except in a situation where there was a fire. So how do you, I know you began your remarks with the argument that the majority of other jurisdictions have held that property, the rescue doctrine is extended to property, but in really looking at some of these cases, it doesn't appear to be the reality of what some of those cases held. How do you respond to that?
I agree. I think there are about 9 or 10 cases out there that cite the restatement in total and quote the language both about property of the third party as well as persons. Those cases, 9 or 10 of them, deal with the rescue of people. I think the Hollingsworth case deals with people in a car who are getting carbon monoxide poisoning. Absolutely agree, Madam Justice, and that's 100% correct. There's another 10 or 11 cases that do deal just with property as opposed to the rescue of people. Those property types being rescued or the types of peril that we're talking about generally involves rolling vehicles, fires. I think one of them involved a hospital bed. So there are classes of property that have been dealt with by these other jurisdictions.
But aren't they all categories, following up on Justice Pierre-Louis, aren't they all in situations where there may be a person involved? I mean, there I suppose could be a home engulfed in fire where everyone knows the person, everybody's out and no one is in there. But if someone sees a fire and volunteers to help with the fire department, as in some of these cases, and is injured, there's some element of there might be a person in there, isn't there?
In some of those cases, there are, but not all of them.
And a rolling vehicle can kill someone.
Sure, sure.
So the person is not intervening to save the vehicle. The person is intervening to potentially save the vehicle from causing harm to someone at the bottom of the hill.
Following up on that, don't these cases involve danger to others where the rescue of property is designed to address the danger to another?
Not all of them. Not all of them. Many of them do. I'll concede that. Many of them do, but not all of them. Some of them purely, I forget which state it was from, but one of them involved a person who had climbed a ladder to hose off a building that wasn't yet on fire to prevent a fire from spreading. And that building, it was a building. Another one was a truck that had some building materials inside of it that was parked that had caught on fire, and the person wanted to save the materials in the truck.
But even those cases, they're preemptive or in-the-moment efforts to guard against a danger that would befall others, no?
No, I think in those cases that, I mean, hypothetically, a truck that was parked and on fire could hurt someone in some way, but I think that specific case is one that comes to mind that struck me as fairly clear that there was no one in the vehicle. It was purely a rescue of the materials.
Trucks on fire can explode and create danger to the surrounding area.
I don't disagree, and I don't disagree that nearly all these cases involve some instrumentality like fire or a vehicle. I think the point here is that none of them limited the issue. None of them said, this case involves fire, and therefore we're going to apply this doctrine but limit it to dangerous instrumentalities.
Cardozo's principle would seem to apply outside. Now, I'll put the word reasonably foreseeable. I mean, so if the negligent person should have reasonably foresaw that someone would come to the rescue, that's what he's talking about. So even if a neighbor knows that the adjoining house is empty because his friends have gone on vacation and the house is on fire, it would probably be reasonably foreseeable that the neighbor would make some effort, if it were reasonable to do so, to try to put out the fire so that his neighbor's house doesn't burn down. And that principle would seem to apply, at least in that circumstance, directly to Cardozo's statement that danger invites risk. That's what you're arguing.
I agree, and the law doesn't and shouldn't ignore the reaction of the mind, and that's what this
but
is about.
Is it your position, you started with the Cardozo quote, was he referring to danger to property, pure danger to property? The car is rolling down the hill and it might mess up somebody's lawn. That's all we're talking about. Do you really think that he was thinking about danger to someone's lawn or to a car hitting the garage or something like that? Is that danger that he's talking about?
You know, it may well be. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Justice Cardozo was one of the founders of the American Law Institute that ultimately promulgates and aggregates the restatement. And if he didn't mean it in 1921, it certainly is being part of this organization.
ALI is an enormous organization, and sure, Not everyone necessarily is you know.
So take the core principle, danger invites rescue, that you've begun with, and translate that to the area that you're asking the doctrine be extended now. What is the danger with respect to the animal, to the pet? Maybe a strong emotional tug. There may be genuine love between and amongst family members and the dog, but what is the danger that is inviting the rescue?
The danger is the danger to the property, and the property in this case happens to be a family pet. That is the danger. The danger is not limited to danger to humans, danger to persons, danger to life and limb. It should apply to property, and under reasonably foreseeable circumstances, a plaintiff should be entitled to relief when engaging in a rescue of property.
Even seeing, like, a big dog attacking another dog, a third person comes there. The question is it reasonably foreseeable that this Good Samaritan is going to try to save the smaller dog? And what I derive from Cardozo, who wrote the book, The Common Law, too, so no matter what he said in that state, that case, he believed in the accretion of the law, is whether or not human nature will impel someone to do this, to come to the rescue, whether it's for a person or in certain circumstances where property is so valuable, like a person's home, not the person's lawn, where the person may lose their entire house and all their belongings, even though they're not home, whether or not human nature will reasonably direct the person to try to make some reasonable effort to put out the fire. And I think that's what he was talking about. No?
That's exactly what he was talking about.
Anything else you'd like to add to your argument?
No.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Wright. Thank you, Mr. Wright. Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chief Justice and honorable members of this court, perhaps it would be appropriate at this point to quote from the 1871 case of the New York State Court of Appeals that Justice Cardozo relied upon. The law has so high a regard for human life that it will not impute negligence to an effort to preserve it. That's the earliest, in all this case research, that's the earliest articulation of the rescue doctrine that I can find. And it involves human life. And Justice Cardozo, to my knowledge, did not say a word about property. Now, when we were in the law division, this case was all about property. And the plaintiff's argument was quite simple. The rescue doctrine should apply to all rescuers and all property. And the judge who heard the motion posed a simple question to counsel. If a beach ball were to, an unattended beach ball were to blow into the Chesapeake Bay, would the estate of the rescuers who went to retrieve the ball in the bay have a claim against the owner of the ball? Counsel answered yes. That's the only answer you can give when the doctrine applies to all rescuers and all property. And that was the appeal that was made to the appellate division when this case went up, until we got to the reply brief, when there was a suggestion, no, maybe we'll make another category for dogs. And there was a reference to Old Yeller and Marley and Me. And yes, society's attitude towards dogs has reached such an apex that we now can put animals on a plane with human life. You know, I respectfully submit, Your Honor, to this court, the purpose of the rescue doctrine was to encourage the rescue of human life. It would not serve the interests of New Jersey society to encourage citizens to put their own lives or physical well-being in peril to protect property, whether it be a Timex, whether it be a Rolex, whether it be a beach ball, or whether it be a pet. You know, if I were to run into my neighbor's house, my neighbor's burning house, to save their baby and died, my children would say their father died a hero. If I were to run into my neighbor's burning house to save their dog, my children would say, whatever possessed him to do that?
Counsel. Suppose, but what is it at peril is a portrait of George Washington painted originally when he was alive, and the portrait is in danger of destruction, and the person runs into the property to try to salvage a priceless and not replaceable part of our history and a work of art, and is injured by it. How would you react to that?
That, Your Honor, I respectfully submit that would be on the other side of the bright line this court should draw. You know, in history, there may have been some property, whether it was a barn or a farmer's mule, the destruction of which would have wreaked economic ruin on the farmer and his family. I mean, there are circumstances where property might be worth preserving, right? But the portrait of George Washington, as valuable as it is, as rare as it is, as unique as it is simply not worth the imperiling of a human life. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The War of 1812 would disagree with you.
I'm sorry?
I think the people who fought the War of 1812 would disagree with you.
You know, they might. I'm not saying no one can disagree with that. As I say, there's a line to be drawn. When and to what will we encourage people to imperil their lives to rescue? And that's what I think is the core issue here. There's been other issues mentioned, the foreseeability, or as counsel would have this. The only thing we should consider is the instinct of the rescuer. I disagree with that, Your Honor.
Following up on that, why is your adversary says, oh, not to worry, the ridiculous case will be rejected by a jury or perhaps on summary judgment based on the reasonableness standard. And there's also foreseeability, but the reasonableness standard. Why is that not a rule that would guard against absurd results?
The trial courts need some guidance. There was some reference to the category of one of the justices mentioned to the categories of property that we may put into subject to the rescue doctrine or not. But just to leave it an open question, which is essentially what counsel is asking.
To ask the question more precisely, the counsel says the panacea is the reasonableness standard. That'll keep out all the property that's not worth saving. Why do you feel that is not sufficient to guard against results?
Because a trial judge will rule that reasonableness is an issue for the jury to determine, not the court. That's why I don't think that's an adequate protection. We're going to leave it up to the however many civil trial judges there are in New Jersey. We're going to leave it up to each one of them individually. Okay, I'll be the gatekeeper here, and therefore a Timex doesn't go to a jury, but a Rolex does. It would lead to a spectrum of results that would be utterly unpredictable, Your Honor. I think a much brighter line and much more specific guidance can be given to the trial courts.
Every day in our courtrooms, judges are making determinations whether or not to grant summary judgment based upon issues such as foreseeability. And you could use the absurd examples like the beach ball, and the watch. Those cases we know are going to be thrown out. And this, the notion that the rescue doctrine applying to property or chattels is a crazy notion doesn't seem to really have traction, at least as a crazy notion. I mean, because the second restatement of torts includes this. I'm not saying that means that we should adopt it, but it's not a crazy notion. It's a policy decision that this court must ultimately make. Do you agree?
Yes, I do.
So, counsel, why shouldn't the court follow the respected authority and the restatement, which extends to property and includes limits?
I'm sorry, did you say include limits, Your Honor?
The restatement itself includes certain limits on the doctrine and yet extends it to property. Why shouldn't we follow that authority?
I don't know if I understand your question correctly, Your Honor. I don't know that the restatement imposes any specific limits on...
The effort can't be an unreasonable one, and the plaintiff can't act unreasonably in the course of the rescue. That's what I was referring to.
All right. You know, I don't believe that any articulation by this court would provide adequate guidance to a trial court. We consider the subject of houses, as Justice Patterson mentioned, We can look at all these cases across the country that cite the restatement, but the one almost universal common thread in all these cases is that it's human life that was at risk in each of these cases, or an instrumentality that was that could imperil human life. And you know, to extend it to the rescue of property, reasonable efforts or a reasonable consideration or a property of reasonable value, and we're leaving all of that up to a jury or to 200 trial judges to determine, well, this is valuable enough, but that's not valuable enough.
Isn't that how we charge juries on simple negligence every day? The reasonable person, not the most cautious, not the most bold, but the average person, that's how we determine reasonableness in every jury trial?
We do that every day.
We can't possibly give a laundry list of Timex, no good. Rolex, okay. George Washington painting, no good.
Well, then it seems to me, Your Honor,
why can't we rely on the standard jury charge that we use in every jury trial to explain to the jury that a reasonable person is not the most bold nor the most cautious, but the average person, and apply that to this and use that? Because it's worked pretty well, as far as I can tell, for a long time.
Well, Your Honor, all I would say is that would leave the rescue of any piece of property, including the beach ball in the Chesapeake Bay, to a jury to decide.
Use that example, because that's never going to fly. No court in this state is going to say that it's reasonable to put your life in danger to save a beach ball. Who's going to do that? I mean, that is an absurd example, and that's the one you're pushing.
It's not the one I'm pushing, Your Honor. It was the one that was pushed in response to an argument that was really repeated today by counsel, and that is it should apply to all property and all rescuers, and we'll leave it up to the jury to determine.
No reasonable person is going to expose his or her life to peril to save a beach ball, but they might do it for a pet, a dog, not a hamster. Okay, not a squirrel, but a dog, provided that it's reasonable to undertake the danger. That is, the danger isn't so great, so grave, that it would be unreasonable to make the effort. Like in this case, I don't know, it might have been unreasonable to jump into that canal. That would, if we accepted the doctrine, the first thing the court would have to do is apply the summary judgment standard, and if it got past that, then a jury would have to make that decision. Why is that such a terrible approach?
Less than 10 years ago, this court expressed concern about attempting to draw a line as to what pets might be included in a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim and what pets wouldn't. Right. And I would say the same applies here. I don't know what's happened in 10 years to make it any easier.
First of all, that is a completely different story, because that we're talking about now the emotional distress. We don't even permit people outside of intimate, familial settings to be able to benefit from that. So forget about pets. We don't even permit other human beings to benefit from that rule. That's a completely different circumstance from this.
It was a different set of circumstances, but the court did express that concern in the majority, in the opinion. You know, the idea that someone else's pet, we should encourage someone to rescue someone else's pet,
The question is, and this is what basically Cardozo's talking about, is it reasonably foreseeable that someone would make the effort, that that's just human nature, and that your negligence, someone's negligence, has now impelled someone to react the way we would expect a person ordinarily to react, okay? Not in some crazy way, to save a beach ball, but in some ordinary way, where the person isn't unreasonably imperiling his or her own life in doing so.
I think the character of the character of whatever it is that's being rescued is what is the most important consideration here, Your Honor. And this doctrine has its genesis in human life. That's what the law holds in such a high regard that the that gave birth to the rescue doctrine. And a pet's life or any of the other inanimate objects we've mentioned don't rise to that level. It is the character of what's being rescued, I think, that matters most, and that is what should impel this court's decision.
Is your argument supported by the discussions that we've had regarding the value, the monetary value of different types of inanimate objects, the Rolex, the Timex, a valuable painting versus a print that you ordered from a online?
I would say yes, Your Honor. I mean, I don't know what the most expensive dog in the world is, but I suspect you can get just about any breed you want for under $500. I mean, we're talking about something that's sentimental value.
No, but I'm not talking about pets here. I'm talking about objects that are like the Timex, the Rolex. What I'm suggesting is that the discussion of maybe something very, very valuable would be in and something inexpensive would be not in. At that point, we're putting a monetary value on an event that might have injured somebody or killed them.
There are a lot of responses I could make to that. You know, a burning house has been used as an example, many times during this discussion. With the ubiquity of property insurance, I would never enter a burning house if there was no one in it. And I just don't know that that monetary value alone solves that consideration.
You're misunderstanding my question. I'm not suggesting it does. Does it help your argument that it is difficult to distinguish among Timexes and Rolexes without just putting a dollar figure on rescue that you're saying should just be out of the picture entirely?
Yes, it does help my argument, Your Honor. That is so difficult that the more obvious, the more palpable answer is we'll limit this to human life.
So, I don't want to belabor this. The burning building. Maybe someone wouldn't run into a burning building to throw a pail of water, but someone might get their hose out and start trying to wash down the outside to put out the flames, and maybe something would fall and hit the person in the head. And under your doctrine, it's too bad. Too bad that you made the effort, the reasonable effort, to put your hose on the house, even though the person may have negligently left some heater or on or whatever. That would be the result, right?
That would be the result, Your Honor.
Any questions, anyone?
No.
Anything you'd like to add to your argument, Mr.
No, Brown? Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's going to